showers and thunderstorms, a high both days 90. Right now it's cloudy, 87. I'm speaking plainly with Bill Hay in 30 minutes.
Welcome to another edition of Hey Doc. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm your host for the next half hour. With me today is my co-host and wife, Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT. Together, we hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining. There is an orthopedic problem called carpal tunnel. You may have heard of it affecting your friends, your family, or even have it yourself. It's an ornery disease causing a lot of daily annoyances in those that have it. It can even be bilateral, meaning that it's affecting both wrists.
To understand it, we always have to go back to anatomy. So, we not only understand what happens when you have carpal tunnel syndrome, but also why it occurs in the first place.
If you put your hand palm up in front of you with your hand bent as far back as it goes, you'll be looking down the carpal tunnel. In the hand itself, not including the fingers and thumb, there are 13 bones. 8 of them are called carpal bones, and the other 5 are the metacarpal bones that make up the bones of the palm of the hand. These bones are held together by ligaments.
Since today's topic is carpal tunnel syndrome, we are only going to mention the anatomical structures of the palmar side of the wrist, including several tendons that, when contracted, cause the wrist to bend forward and, to some degree, side to side.
The carpal tunnel is not the only cause of wrist pain and limited movement of the wrist. There are also some of the arthritic diseases, such as rheumatoid arthritis. The word wrist is spelled with a W, that is, W-R-I-S-T. Possibly, the W-R at the start being symbolic of the sound of twisting, as in the words wringing, such as wringing a towel, or writhing, twisting around.
The carpal tunnel is a narrow passageway in the wrist, about an inch wide. The floor and sides of the tunnel are formed by the small carpal bones.
The carpal tunnel protects the median nerve and flexor tendons that bend the fingers and the thumb. The roof of the tunnel is a strong band of connective tissue that's called the transverse carpal ligament. Because these boundaries are very rigid, the carpal tunnel has little capacity to stretch or increase in size. Remember that most of our nerves originate as a group of nerve roots in the neck. These roots come together to form a single nerve in the arm.
The median nerve goes down the arm and forearm, passes through the carpal tunnel at the wrist in order to get into the hand. The nerve provides feelings in the thumb and index, middle and ring fingers. The nerve also controls the muscle around the base of the thumb.
The 9 tendons that bend the fingers and thumb, called flexor tendons, also travel through the carpal tunnel. If for whatever reason the carpal tunnel becomes narrowed, or when tissues surrounding the flexor tendons swell, they put pressure on the median nerve. These tendons are naturally making it easier to move your fingers. But when this tissue, called the synovium, swells, it takes up space in the carpal tunnel, and over time, it crowds the nerve. This abnormal pressure on the nerve can result in pain, numbness, tingling, as well as weakness in the hand. So the symptoms of carpal tunnel are caused by pressure on the median nerve as it travels through the carpal tunnel. But what causes this to occur?
Most often, it is not just what causes, but several that comes together to cause carpal tunnel syndrome. It is more often seen in women and older people, and heredity can be an important factor.
Some people may simply have a smaller carpal tunnel, or there may be anatomic differences that change the amount of space for the median nerve. But a major cause is repetitive activities of the same hand and wrist motions over a prolonged period of time. This could aggravate the tendons in the wrist, causing swelling that puts pressure on the nerve. And it's not just repetitive action, but extreme flexion or extension of the hand and wrist for a prolonged period of time that can increase pressure on the nerve. There is another cause that is not so well known that can initiate carpal tunnel syndrome, and that is pregnancy.
Hormonal changes during pregnancy can cause swelling. Also, health conditions, including diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, and thyroid gland imbalance are conditions that are associated with carpal tunnel syndrome.
So what can you expect your doctor to do if he suspects that you have symptoms that are due to carpal tunnel syndrome? Apart from a complete general health and medical history, as well as a discussion of your present symptoms, the physician will carefully examine your hand and wrist.
There are a number of physical tests that your doctor might do to test for carpal tunnel syndrome.
First, you may look for something called Tinel sign. To do this, the physician will press down or tap along the median nerve at inside of your wrist to see if it causes any numbness or tingling in your fingers. He may also hold your wrists in a flexed position to test for numbness or tingling in your hands. The sensitivity in your fingertips and hands may be tested by lightly touching them with a special instrument when your eyes are closed. A check for weakness in the muscles around the base of the thumb will be tested, and he will look for atrophy in the muscles around the base of your thumb.
At some point, the physician may perform some electrophysiological test in order to measure how well your median nerve is working and help determine whether there is too much pressure on the nerve.
This could also help your physician determine if there are other causes of your symptoms, such as neuropathy, or even other sites of nerve compression that might be contributing to your symptoms. One type of electrophysiological test is the nerve conduction study.
This test actually measures the signal traveling in the nerves of your hand and arm and can detect when a nerve is not conducting its signal effectively.
Another test, called electromyogram or EMG, can be used to measure the electrical activities in muscles. Thus, the EMG can show whether you have any nerve or muscle damage. Ultrasound of your wrist may be used to evaluate the median nerve for signs of compression.
X-rays and magnetic resonance imaging, MRI scans provide images of the body's soft tissues. An MRI can also help your doctor determine if there are problems with the nerve itself, such as scarring from an injury or tumor.
Once the diagnosis of carpal tunnel has been made, the physician needs to start considering a treatment plan. Now, if your symptoms are mild, your doctor will most likely recommend non-surgical treatment initially. This might include wearing a wrist brace to reduce pressure on the median nerve by keeping your wrist straight. You may only be asked to wear the brace or even a splint at night in order to prevent you from bending your wrist while you sleep.
This reduces pressure on the nerve in the carpal tunnel. It may also help to wear a splint during the day when doing activities that aggravate your symptoms.
If these things don't work, then the physician may recommend a steroid injection into the carpal tunnel, which may relieve symptoms at least for a period of time. Corticosteroid or cortisone can be injected. However, their effect is sometimes only temporary. Now, if non-surgical treatment does not relieve the symptoms after that time, your doctor could recommend surgery.
The decision whether to have surgery is based on the severity of your symptoms. You may be reticent to go this route, but in long-standing cases with constant numbness and wasting of your thumb muscles, surgery may be recommended to prevent irreversible damage.
The carpal tunnel release is a surgical procedure with the goal of relieving pressure on your median nerve. It is performed by cutting the ligaments that form the roof of the tunnel. This increases the size of the tunnel and decreases pressure on the median nerve. There is another type of surgery called open carpal tunnel release. In this particular type of procedure, a small incision is made in the palm of your hand, and the surgeon will cut the transverse carpal ligament, which happens again to be the roof of the carpal tunnel. Doing this will increase the size of the tunnel and decrease pressure on the median nerve.
There is also a procedure called endoscopy carpal tunnel release, where one or two smaller skin incisions called portals are made, and an endoscope, which is really a miniature camera, is used to see inside your hand and wrist.
Then a special knife is used to divide the transverse carpal ligament, just as in the open carpal tunnel release procedure, which we talked about earlier.
Recovery is not fast. In fact, grip and pinch strength usually return by about 2 to 3 months after surgery. But if the condition of the median nerve was poor before surgery, however, grip and pinch strength may not improve for up to 1 year.
It's time for our mid-show break, so Carmen and I will be back in just a moment. This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, and I've been the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center for the past 29 years. We're located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just two blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection between the Pottsburg Post Office and the Tulsa Welding School. We will treat your pains, sprains, and strains. Our practice emphasizes chronic pain management as well as anti-aging medicine. We also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any questions about Southside Medical Center, please call us at 641-4411. That's 641-4411. Southside Medical Center, where your health is our primary care. Welcome back to the Hey Doc Show. I have a relative that lives on a well-traveled neighborhood street here in Jacksonville that ends on a major city street. Unfortunately, there's no traffic light at this intersection. In the mornings, there's a school bus that stops close to this intersection, and then there's a lot of traffic in the mornings as well. And there have been a lot of accidents and, imagine, one or two fatalities over the past years. Many of the residents have written to the city asking for a traffic light to be installed to make the intersection safer. There's still no light, and accidents are still commonplace. Those that have written to the city have been told that there has to be at least one or two more fatalities for them to be considering putting in a traffic light. So only real fatalities will cause a city action. The same thing happens in the pharmaceutical world.
There is the case of a young girl, age 11, who has diabetes. She must take daily injections of insulin to stay alive. She's lucky. Insulin keeps her alive, but she's unlucky as her family cannot afford the type of insulin that works for her.
She's tried Humulin, Inovulin, Novolog, but they did not work well. Finally, the doctors tried her on a newer insulin called Apidra, and that worked. Her family has insurance coverage, but it comes as a surprise to many in our country that the insurance does not cover the cost of $250 a vial, because her insurers consider this insulin a tier 3 drug, actually mid-range of all the drug costs. This means that her family must pay $375 each month, since there's no generic alternative to her medication and she uses 1.5 vials a month.
But parents are parents, and these diabetic girl parents turn to the black market as well as a GoFundMe campaign and an insulin swapping Facebook group.
They want to keep their daughter alive, as do millions of others who are basically in the same dilemma as this girl. They can't afford to pay for the life-saving medication.
And as though we are talking about insulin, there are plenty of others in the same dilemma due to the cost of medications for their life-threatening illnesses. Insulin prices have skyrocketed in recent years, on average tripling between 2002 and 2013.
One popular brand, Novolog, increased the list price by 353%. It's almost four times from 2001 to 2016. Some go to great lengths to raise the money to pay for the medications. On the other hand, other diabetics opt to take less effective insulin or ration what they have. One study actually revealed that 45% of diabetic patients had gone without insulin because of the price. And in some cases, the consequences have been fatal. Insulin was a miraculous discovery. In patients with type 1 diabetes, the pancreas cannot make insulin, a hormone that's vital to maintaining blood sugar to feed the cells of the body. Without insulin to keep blood sugar levels steady, patients can have nerve damage, blindness, heart problems, and they can die. Of the estimated 30 million Americans with diabetes, 7.4 million require insulin.
In 1921, Canadian scientists Frederick Banting and Charles Best created animal insulin. They generously sold the patent to the University of Toronto for $1 each in hopes of ensuring life-saving treatment for all who needed it.
So who is at fault for those extraordinary high prices of medications? Well, it's not just the drug makers. Pharmacy benefit managers, a group that you may never even have heard of, control which insulins are on an insurer's list of approved drugs and gets rebates from the manufacturers to do so. They can exclude a drug if the rebate's too low. The result is that what one person pays for insulin could be vastly different from what another pays. By the time the insulin gets from the factory where it's made until it comes all the way down the chain to the patient, there are a lot of people who profit off of the sale of the insulin.
One of the things that's different in other countries is not as many people add to the price of the insulin before it gets to the patients. So that keeps the cost down.
Americans pay more for insulin than people in any other nation. In 2017, American diabetes patients paid $237 billion in direct medical costs. Now that's an average of $16,750 per patient, accounting for one in four healthcare dollars spent that year.
Before we talk some more about this dilemma, let us talk about some of the dangers that patients face with insulin rationing.
Let's take the example of a diabetic who was paying $250 a month for his insulin. Although this was expensive, it was doable until he lost his insurance. The out-of-pocket expense was $1,300 for a month's supply. This diabetic left the pharmacy without anything, thinking he could make what he had in his supplies last until payday. This patient died about 4 days before his paycheck. He died from ketoacidosis, when the body can't use sugar in the blood for energy, so it burns fat and muscle instead. It leads to the buildup of acids called ketones. The cause? Well, that's lack of insulin.
Regardless of whether you have type 1 or type 2 diabetes, you are going to end up with higher blood sugars. And over periods of time, that can result in really bad effects.
Skipping doses could lead to vision, kidney, and nerve damage over time. And when patients have the symptoms of ketoacidosis, these include confusion, dehydration, frequent urination, muscle weakness, and eventually coma, insulin is the only thing that can help them. Without it, they can die. And turning to the black market for insulin could be equally dangerous. Just like heroin and cocaine, you don't know what you're getting. It could be dirty. It could be laced.
Many opt to taking all the forms of insulin, such as the type sold at Walmart for $25, but this requires strict meal planning and multiple daily shots, and they don't work for everyone.
The poor people get the old, less effective, hard-to-manage insulin, whereas the people who can afford it, they get the top-of-the-line insulin that's easier to manage. The real problem is that both the pharmaceutical industry and the pharmacy benefit managers do not want to change. They prefer that the price controls stay just where they are. A dozen patients are presently suing drug makers for alleged price fixing.
The suit alleges price fixing and inflated costs by the companies and pharmacies benefit managers, saying that when the price of one insulin drug goes up, the other ones do as well.
The U.S. Senate Committee on Aging earlier this year held a hearing on this issue. And an online petition by the American Diabetes Association calling for increased transparency and more affordable insulin has collected over a third of a million signatures. In 2017, lawmakers in Nevada passed a law requiring more transparency in insulin pricing. First, manufacturers set a base price for their drugs. Then they negotiate with third parties known as pharmacy benefit managers.
These pharmacy benefit managers are hired by insurance companies. The pharmacist benefit manager have a great power in deciding which brand of drug an insurance company will cover for its customers.
For example, the pharmacy benefits manager can negotiate lower prices from the manufacturers. Suppose that a manufacturer lists a drug at $100 a dose. Pharmacy benefit managers might negotiate that price for the insurance company down to $80. But the consumer, that's the one that's in need of the drug, would still pay $100 before any insurance coverage.
So drug companies blame the pharmacy benefit managers for the higher price consumers are paying. In the meantime, insurance companies blame manufacturers.
One of the Sanofi spokeswomen said that the company in 2017 made a commitment to limit price increases to no greater than medical inflation, which is the rate at which healthcare costs in general rise each year. But even after a drug manufacturer sets the list price, the negotiation with the pharmacy benefit managers impacts the final costs. Pharmacy benefit managers demand greater savings. As the rebates, discounts, and price concessions go up, the manufacturers, well, they simply try maintaining a profit margin that's been dropping. To make up that loss, the company would continue to raise the original list price to maintain a profitable and sustainable business. Pharmacy benefit managers, meanwhile, dispute the claim that they're responsible for drug costs going up. The big problem is that no one sees an end to this, and the consumers are the ones that suffer. Now, if you'd like to see more information on this and more depth on it, then I recommend you a website. Go to truecostofhealth.com. Apart from information on the pharmaceutical industry, it also talks about hospitals and general health care and how you pay for it. Again, truecostofhealthcare.com.
As a quick piece from that website, the author, Dr. David Belt, MD, shows the cost both here in the U.S. and Canada for various medications.
For example, Humalog insulin in the United States costs $12.40 a vial, while in Canada, the cost is only $2.78. 18 milligram Spiriva, that costs $10.98 a capsule, while across the border in Canada, the Canadians pay $2.34 a capsule. And the list goes on and on and on.
If you have been denied any medication at your pharmacy, please listen to the following. Rule 64B16-27.831 became effective on June 14, 2018. The rule is titled Standards of Practice for the Filling of Controlled Substance Prescriptions.
The rule revision begins with a clear statement. The Board of Pharmacy recognizes that it is important for the patients of the state of Florida to be able to fill valid prescriptions for controlled substances. In filling these prescriptions, the Board does not expect pharmacists to take any specific action beyond exercising sound professional judgment. Pharmacists should not fear disciplinary action from the board or other regulatory or enforcement agencies for dispensing controlled substances for legitimate medical purposes in the usual course of professional practice.
Every patient's situation is unique, and prescriptions for controlled substances shall be reviewed with each patient's unique situation in mind.
Pharmacists shall attempt to work with the patient and the prescriber to assist in determining the validity of the prescription.
When validating a prescription, the pharmacist shall ensure that all communication with the patient is not overheard by others.
Certain minimal standards before a pharmacy or pharmacist can refuse to fill a prescription were outlined in the bill. The bill requires that the pharmacist initiate communication with the patient or the patient's representative to acquire information relevant to the concern with the validity of the prescription.
If the pharmacist is not able to communicate with the physician, the pharmacist may elect to access the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program's database to acquire information relevant to pharmacists concerned with the validity of the prescription.
The pharmacist must initiate communication with the prescriber or the prescriber's agent to acquire information relevant to the pharmacist's concern with the validity of the prescription. So, if your pharmacist has refused to fill your prescriptions and you feel that they have not lived up to or confirmed to the bill that we have just resumed, then you may complain to the pharmacy head, the Florida Board of Pharmacy, or, if you are disabled, an attorney for possible violation of the American with Disabilities Act. I'd like you, our listeners, to know that I am one of several physicians right here in the Jacksonville area that has received the certification to recommend medical marijuana to those patients with certain qualifying diagnoses. These now include amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, cancer, Crohn's disease, epilepsy, glaucoma, HIV/AIDS, seizure disorders, chronic muscle spasms, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, PTSD, a terminal condition, as well as other ailments and conditions, including certain diseases with chronic or long-term pain. For more information, you can call our office at 641-4411. We have also set up a special website at CompassionateCareJax.com, where you can get a whole lot more information on medical marijuana. You can also set up an appointment for an office visit to Southside Medical Center right on the website. Again, that website is CompassionateCareJax.com. Well, we've come to the end of another Hey Doc Show. Carmen and I hope that you've enjoyed the past half hour and have found it interesting, educational, and maybe just a little bit entertaining.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.